From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 12th day of May, 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in a few moments, we'll talk with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois. A bit later in the program, Matt Blaisdell of the Anderson Climbers Facility in Delphi, Indiana, will join us to take up the cash grain market. We'll hear from Drew Lerner, World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City, about the agricultural weather forecast. And Daryl Good will be here to talk about the Chinese imports of corn from the United States. It is, however, a conversation I had with Daryl last week, so be wary of that one just a bit. And then in the second half hour of our program today, we call that The Farming World. It's available on some of these radio stations and online at willag.org. We'll talk with Purdue Ag economist Chris Hurt about the livestock sector. He says the beef industry is back, and so are hogs. And we'll hear a bit more from entomologist Mike Gray about the approval from USDA of Pioneer's Optimum Acre Max. It all comes up in this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
In Chicago, on this Wednesday afternoon, futures finished the day like this. The nearby contract in the May wheat at 482 and three quarters, down a penny. July, the harvest month at 491 and a half, a penny and three quarters lower. And September at 508 and a half for the soft red, down a penny and three quarters. July hard red in Kansas City at 507 on the settlement price, down 2.5 cents. From the corn pit back in Chicago at the CME Group, a 2 cent gain at $3.71 and three quarters for the May futures. July, 378 and a quarter, up a penny and a quarter. And September corn, 384 and a quarter, up one quarter. December contract, 392 and a half, down a half. The March at 404 and a quarter, down a penny. Soy complex now, May bean futures, 959 and a half, up a penny and a quarter. July at 965 and a half, down a half. August at 960 and a quarter, down 2 and a quarter. September, 944 and a quarter, a penny and three quarters lower. And the harvest month, November futures, 937 and a half, unchanged today. January, up a quarter at 946 and a half. May meal at 281.30, down a dollar. May oil up 13 at 38.16. June live cattle at 95.70, 110 lower. The May feeders at 111.50, down 60. And May lean hogs at 88.45 were 52 and a half cents higher on the afternoon. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil, June contract, $75.32 a barrel, down $1.04. June ethanol at $1.64.3. That's just about a half cent higher. Natural gas at $4.28, up 14.9 cents. Heating oil on the June contract at $2.15.5, up a penny and a half. And the gold futures now at $1,242.70 an ounce, a settlement price $22.80 higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average at 10,879, up about 132 points. And the Goldman Sachs at 520.35 is 3.53 higher on the afternoon. The weather forecast for the two-state region looks like this. In the south and central parts of Indiana for tonight, partly to mostly cloudy, elsewhere mostly cloudy, some scattered showers, some thunderstorms. Those will be most numerous in northwestern and west central Illinois. Lows will range from 48 in northern Illinois to 72 in the southern part of Indiana. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy skies, scattered showers, a few thunderstorms. Highs from 62 in northwestern Illinois to 86 in southeastern Indiana. Flooding has occurred in eastern Missouri and southwestern Illinois, as well as portions of southern Indiana. Heavy rains over the next 36 hours will result in more flooding, especially in west central Illinois and continuing into southern Indiana. Of course, some planting and field work will resume by early next week as dry weather is expected for most locations this work week and through the weekend. We'll have a more complete look at the agricultural weather forecast at the bottom of the hour.
Support for WILL comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks by developing dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is at stuart-peterson.com.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. On the phone line with us to take a look at the agricultural futures markets on this Wednesday afternoon, Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois. Good to talk to you, Paul.
Hey, good afternoon, Todd.
What'd you make of the marketplace today?
Well, it's interesting to watch the silver and gold market continue its rally, and it's very interesting to see how the corn market reacted with positive overnight news. And of course, it's also interesting to watch the dollar react. And it was a pretty uneventful day. Also, the interesting thing, of course, is this China rumors of buying corn. They're becoming more plentiful, and the volumes are increasing a little. When the Chinese story erupted and we saw the sharply higher opening, I think there was a lot of farmers wanting cash flow, and there was some selling that hit the marketplace, and I'm sure selling in South America as well.
You think that was the right thing to do?
My opinion is on the corn is a couple things. We are hearing about a very large exporter of grain calling almost every farmer in a three-state area wanting to buy corn on a basis or something. And, of course, does that mean they have a bunch of bad corn that they want to blend, or they need corn to process, or they need something? But that's an interesting thing. Number two, it is interesting to see the number of farmers that need cash flow. Number three, there's a lot of corn inventory out there, and the Chinese would have to buy a lot of corn. I guess I'm really holding out for levels above the 410-20 level on the new Dease corn before I would get too excited about it. And, of course, the good news is I've already sold all my little crop corn at $4 north.
Yeah, the wire service says that I think the name of the company is Kofco, which is a state-owned out of China, was the importer, and that Bunge probably was the exporter of the announcements, at least overnight. It's a small amount again, like the last time around. There were a couple of cargoes, I think, the last time around, not so long ago. But it does bode well, does it not? Because this time around, if Reuters is right, that's where the wire service I saw was, and it's a state-owned, it really means that China may be in the marketplace in a much bigger way, and that they are having they're having a supply problem of some sort, whether that's driven by just it not being in the right place or having a short crop last year.
Well, that's right. And, I'm sure the hog, the feed mills decide to go through the state agency maybe for a couple of reasons, switching optional origin. They're getting sophisticated as well. Switch inventory of state-owned grain with non-state-owned grain.
Mm-hmm.
If they bought it maybe optional origin, it could go into Argentina or some other country. We doubt that, but anyway, that was rumored in the trade. And then at the same time, it's probably good to pay somebody a commission, because if you buy it through the state, it's at least likely the deal could go sour and your export permits or import permits won't disappear. But, the marketplace says that it can be done. They have to pay some tariffs. They have to pay some pretty hefty transportation fees. It all adds up. Arithmetic is there that it'll work. So, and the spread between U.S. corn and Chinese corn is at very, very wide levels.
Yeah, well, and then in the end, I suppose it all comes down to the U.S. balance sheet, which looks like it's still going to be pretty good sized at the end of this year and at the end of the next year, according to USDA.
Yeah, that's true. And if the trade rumors are that if the Chinese buy 2 to 4 million tons of corn this year, instead of the 680,000 tons that are basically being talked about, that's another factor, and we can snug the balance sheet up a little more. I generally feel that this is good news, and the fact that it does snug the balance sheet up a little bit, and it doesn't put such a burden on just cheap corn. As we all can look at the elevator boards, it's awfully cheap in the United States today.
Anything else that we ought to be looking at in the marketplace for the day, news out of the soybean complex or other places?
Well, it is interesting. Last several days, we did see one interesting note that the soybean crush margins in China on soybean processing are $1.50 to $2 a bushel. And when soybean crush margins are $1 a bushel, lots of things happen at a soybean processing industry. We buy new curtains and buy new rugs on the floor, and, you know, things change. When it's that much over in China, there ought to be some things happening, too. So it does underscore that it's very profitable to buy soybeans and process them. And, you know, maybe we will see this tremendous demand continue. And the point I'm trying to make is maybe we don't have to go to $8, but I'm going to say that $9 is still going to clear a lot of land in Brazil and encourage a lot of production next year.
Thank you so much for being with
us. Have a profitable day.
You too. Paul Cooley is with ADM Investor Services out of Oakland, Illinois. He joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Wednesday afternoon. If you'd like to hear Paul again, you can always do that online at willag.org. That's willag.org.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Rebecca King in Galesburg at 309-341-5007. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
You are listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. Your Director of Ag Programming is here now, Dave Dickey, with today's Ag News.
In agricultural news, the White House Task Force on Childhood Obesity issued a report yesterday in which it outlined specific actions that can be taken by government and private industry. The panel suggests economic incentives could help eradicate so-called food deserts, urban and rural areas with few, if any, supermarkets and grocery stores. The report also says federally funded and private insurance plans should cover services necessary to treat and prevent childhood obesity. A USDA official says nearly one in four people are now fed in some manner through a federal program, whether it's food stamps, school lunches, or a special program for women with infants. Kevin Concannon says that the number of people who get food stamps rose to 39.7 million in February, the last month for which data is available. That's an increase of more than 7 million beneficiaries since February of 2009. Concannon also said that almost 32 million children eat school lunches and that 49% of infants are on the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, known as WIC. A U.S. Senate compromise bill aimed at battling global warming would cut emissions of greenhouse gases 17% by 2020, according to a summary given to senators. The legislation being offered by Democratic Senator John Kerry and Independent Senator Joseph Lieberman also contains incentives to expand U.S. nuclear power generation and offshore oil drilling. A recall of romaine lettuce that has sickened students with E. coli poisoning is expanding as the government tries to find out where the contamination occurred. At least 19 people have been sickened in connection with the E. coli outbreaks. The Food and Drug Administration says it is investigating the Yuma, Arizona farm where the romaine lettuce was harvested and is attempting to determine the point in the supply chain where the contamination occurred. The Wall Street Journal today reports that U.S. federal investigators are probing whether Morgan Stanley misled investors about mortgage derivative products it helped create and sometimes bet against. The newspaper reports that two particular deals, named after U.S. Presidents James Buchanan and Andrew Jackson, were scanned by investigators. Morgan Stanley spokesperson Mark Lake denied the newspaper report, saying, quote, "We have not been contacted by the Justice Department about the transactions being raised by the Wall Street Journal, and we have no knowledge of a Justice Department investigation into these transactions." And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. By the way, that's the name of the second half hour of this program. It's available on some of these radio stations and always online at willag.org in the full version of the Closing Market Report. You can listen to it online at willag.org. Today, we'll talk with Purdue Extension Ag Economist Chris Hurt and entomologist from the University of Illinois, Mike Gray, a double dose of university folks today on the farming world. You can stay with us this afternoon for that on some of these radio stations or listen online at willag.org. Speaking of ag economist, we talked last week with Daryl Good just a bit about the Chinese imports that were rumored from USDA. And then, of course, today, there is some confirmation that the Chinese were back in the market through COFCO. That's one of their larger import houses, and it's state-owned. And so they've still been dabbling a bit in the marketplace. When I spoke with Daryl the last time around, he told me that it had been a long time since, well, the Chinese had been in the marketplace about 9 years ago in any real big way, a solitary purchase 4 years ago. And then it's been at least 15 years since they were into the marketplace in a way that would change, really, the balance sheet for corn in the United States. He still says that this time around looks a lot more like 9 years ago than 15 years ago, but things are changing steadily. Remember, when we talked to him, it was prior to this morning's announcement of COFCO. Now here's Daryl Good on his view of the Chinese imports.
They've only confirmed, 4 or 5 million bushels. I think you would really have to say we'd like to see 40, 50, maybe up to 100 million bushels of demand from China to really suggest that they are back in the market, maybe on a more or less permanent basis.
Even a purchase of 50 to 100 million bushels, says Daryl Good, doesn't change the U.S. balance sheet too significantly. Still, he calls it a move in the right direction.
And if we are seeing a little better demand in the other sectors as well, ethanol and feed domestically, then all taken together, I think that was enough to kind of reverse the trend. I think the market had been focusing more on early planting and prospects for perhaps more corn acres than intended, maybe above trend yield because of the early planting. So those supply concerns, I think, had begun to weigh on the market, and then along comes a bit of an unexpected demand news that I think kind of reversed that trend. So as a result, we did have a pretty big swing in prices.
Given that, Good says it's really a supply-driven market this season and that old and new crop prices for corn will be decided by the weather.
You know, I really believe that old crop corn is going to be influenced primarily by prospects for the growing crop. Yes, we do have a little better demand, but no indication that we're going to run out of corn prior to harvest. And right now, everything would point to an early harvest in 2010, unlike the late harvest of 2009. So I don't see a tightness in old crop corn supplies developing.
Consequently, if a rally materializes, Daryl Good, again, says it will be related to the weather and won't come until June or July.
It may take that long to develop concerns, given the early planting that we've had. That's a long time to hold old crop corn, particularly if you're worried on-farm conditions, so we may not be able to wait out the market on old crop, and I'm kind of under the opinion that as we get some weekly strength in the market, that we should be doling out the old crop supplies.
As for the new crop corn, Good advises a little patience.
Learned Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learned Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Learned Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Wednesday afternoon. Time to check the cash grain market. The folks at the Andersons are with us in Delphi, Indiana, at their Climbers facility. Matt Blaisdell is on the line. Good afternoon to you, Matt.
Good afternoon.
Did farmers take advantage of the bump in the marketplace this morning?
Yeah, most of them who saw the overnight session did get something done, either pre-market or right on the open. So we did see quite a bit of old crop, some new crop, but for the most part old crop, and it's nearby as guys continue wanting to keep the corn moving here.
How much of it do you think is that it was an opportunity when they were out of the field because of rainfall, or simply the idea that this was where they wanted to market their corn?
You know, I think it's a combination of all of those. I think you're right. I think it's a combination that, you know, some guys are done, but there's still a lot of beans to be planted. So they have some rainy days here. Guys aren't thrilled to hold this crop end of July with some of the quality issues we have. So I think any opportunity that the market gives it a nice bump, as we've seen the first part of this week, they're going to take advantage of it and keep the trucks rolling.
And tell me about quality issues. What kinds of problems are you dealing with there at the elevator?
You know, for the most part, what we've seen here, we do test for VOM, and that has actually not been our biggest issue. We've just seen a lot of common damage, heat damage, you know, cracked and broken. Just this crop didn't go in the bin at ideal conditions, and it's definitely coming out as unideal as soon as you can get.
Yeah, is the heat a problem because it got hot, or is it a problem because they overdried it?
A problem because it got hot. You know, there's a little bit to where you see some damage caused by the dryer, but most of it just got hot or just drying it has cracked the kernels.
Yeah, what's basis like?
Basis has strengthened here. I went up a couple cents on my posted bid here just today, and I'd say in the marketplace here, basis is up anywhere from a few pennies to a nickel here just in the last week.
Why?
I think a lot of it has to do with this. Most people do not have a big book on because there hasn't been a big opportunity for producers to sell anything. So it's kind of to the point now that everybody needs to get a little bit of May corn buy here and not a lot of book on. So, you know, most good people's opinion and mine is point of them that, you know, the corn's out there and it will come, but now we just have to promote it to come.
And what does the landscape for the basis in the beans look like?
You know, beans have surged here in the last, you know, week to 10 days, and they're back to probably the highs that we've seen since early spring here. I think part of the problem is just a lot of producers have sold out of their beans.
What are your bids for the day?
Climbers corn is at 373, Delphi beans at 957.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, bud.
Matt Blaisdell is with the Andersons Climbers facility in Delphi, Indiana, joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Wednesday afternoon. Back in 2 minutes when we take a look at the agricultural weather forecast.
Support for agricultural programming comes from the Westchester Group, an agricultural asset management firm specializing in land auctions for farmland, timberland, and recreational land. More information on upcoming auctions is at westchester-auctions.com or at 800-607-6888.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, the U.S. Commerce Department today says the U.S. trade deficit rose to a 15-month high as rising oil prices pushed crude oil imports to the highest level since the fall of 2008, offsetting another strong gain in exports. The trade deficit rose 2.5% to $40.4 billion in March. It was the biggest monthly trade deficit since December of 2008. Exports of goods and services rose 3.2% to $147.87 billion, the highest level since October of 2008. Imports were also up strongly, rising 3.1% to $188.3 billion. The International Energy Agency today says global oil demand growth this year will be slightly slower than previously expected. The IE lowered its forecast by 50,000 barrels per day to 1.62 million. Demand this year will grow to 86.4 million barrels per day, up from 84.77 million barrels per day. David Fife, head of the IEA's Oil Industry and Markets Division, says the downward revision was in response to new historical data and demand from emerging markets would continue to push up the world's oil use. Nissan's losses for the January-March quarter shrank dramatically as Japan's number three automaker benefited from a global auto recovery and booming car sales in China. Nissan today says its quarterly loss was $125 million. And that's a look at today's business news.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. On this Wednesday afternoon, Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated joins us to take up the agricultural weather forecast. Good afternoon to you, Drew.
Good afternoon, Todd.
What do you see in our forecast?
The models today continue to promote a lot of precipitation across the Midwest here for the rest of this week, taking us into Friday. We will see enough precipitation to maintain saturated or nearly saturated conditions across a big part of the U.S. Corn Belt. And there will be some rain that will develop down in the southern U.S. plains, which has been absent for quite a little while, which will help crops down that way. This is Texas and Oklahoma I'm talking about, and they will pick up on rain over the course of the weekend and into the early part of next week, which will be really important for them. Parts of the Delta in the southeast will encounter some shower and thunderstorm activity over the weekend as well, and that will linger into the early part of next week. Those two areas, the Delta and the southeast, probably need to be watched a little bit more closely because I don't think they're going to get a lot of quantity in the rain that they get. And we are going to see a shift towards drier and warmer weather in the second week of the two-week outlook. So some of those areas down there might end up with a little stress on their hands by the time we finish out the month. Back in the Midwest, though, and after this first week of the forecast, we will see perhaps a drier scenario starting to evolve there as well. And this would be after about the 20th. Some of the model data midday today came out with a pretty mean high-pressure ridge over the heart of the Midwest. We don't think that's going to verify very well, but we do think that there will be a little bit of a warmer flavor to our weather in the second week of the outlook, and that will likely be a beneficial change for the Midwest after the recent wet and cooler bias.
And then if you turn your attention to China and the crop that they're trying, I guess trying is the right word, to get in the ground there, probably some of it in, but it's been a rough start to their growing season.
It really has. In the Northeast particularly, the Northeast was quite cool for an extended period of time and was getting some frequent rain and snows. Well, it's starting to warm up there, but we're still dealing with some moisture surpluses. And so a big part of that Northeast corner of the country where about half of the summer crops are produced is still a little bit too wet. And the forecast for them is for a little bit of a warmer bias coming up, but still some shower activity coming and going. It's definitely a step in the right direction for them, and they should see better progress as we get closer to the end of May, and the June planting of soybeans up there I think will go relatively well. There's a chance they may turn a little dry later in the summer. We're going to watch that real closely. There is an association with drier biases in northeast China in the years in which we shift from El Nino to La Nina, so we're going to watch that, like I said, as we move forward in time.
Speaking of a longer term for forecast, do you have one for the Midwest too for the summer months?
Well, I do think that the Midwest will experience some wild gyrations in temperature, which will probably keep us in the rain every once in a while. I think we'll go through periods of dryness and then experience some warm weather during those drier moments, and then we'll turn right around and bring a little surge of coolness around that will stimulate some shower and thunderstorm activity. So the first half of summer, I think, will go very well, and with all the corn in the ground early this year, we'll see that turn into a pretty good yielding crop. But the second half of summer looks like it'll have a little drier and a little warmer flavor to it. The drier bias in August and September might end up having a little bit of a stressful impact on some of the late season crops like soybeans, so we're going to be watching that real closely. I don't see a lot of excessive heat right now, but a lot of that is going to be determined by any ridge development that we do get in the latter half of the season.
Drew, thanks so much.
Have a great day.
Drew Lerner is with World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report. Stay with us if you can. For the farming world, for the rest of you, visit willag.org. I'm Todd Gleason. This is the Farming World news and interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we'll talk with Chris Hurt, Purdue Extension agricultural economist. Good afternoon, Mr. Hurt. How are you today?
Oh, great to be with you, Todd.
Let's talk about livestock. You recently penned an article that was posted on the FarmDoc site at farmdoc.illinois.edu. And the headline says, "The cattle business is back." Why?
Well, and I think we could even broaden that out to say the cattle and the hog business is back. We have very strong prices. We've seen a dollar a pound in terms of finished cattle prices in recent weeks. We've seen hog futures, the lean hog futures, move very close to their record highs around 90 cents a pound. And this is coming just a few months, really. We even go back to December. And we saw cattle prices back at that time were about $80 a hundredweight. So these are really remarkable recoveries very, very quickly. Now, we look at the reasons, and it's pretty clear the world economy has been on a positive tilt that's going to help us out on the export side in terms of moving meat into the world market. Clearly helps on the domestic side. Consumers are not quite as value-oriented. They're willing to look at a little higher cuts of meat, and certainly willing to put that meat into the both when they eat at restaurants in terms of choice as well as in the grocery store. Another big thing for the animal industries is feed prices. And, of course, feed prices moved up sharply in the fall of 2006 and 2007 into reaching peaks in 2008 and have been moderating basically since that time. Feed's the single biggest cost for the animal industry. So lower prices there are very, very helpful. We also have seen an industry, livestock industries, that took a lot of loss in the last 2 years, and those producers have just simply adjusted. We've seen smaller herds and flocks generally in the United States, but that's true in Canada and generally around the world. So we've got less supply, and we have the really beginnings, I think, of a recovery for our consumers. Just more willingness to buy.
And when you talk about beef exports from the United States, some of the numbers you put into the document suggest that in the first 2 months of this year, beef exports up 24%, beef imports actually down 23% into the United States from other countries. Good news, I suppose, for those beef producers across the U.S.
Well, it clearly is. And again, the data we only have for those first 2 months right now, so a little early to say that we'll follow through with this much strength. But I think the reduction in imports is coming because other countries like Brazil, New Zealand, Australia, there's just other countries that are buying that meat, and that makes less available. They've reduced their herds also. That makes less available to come into the United States. So for the year, USDA is looking for about a 13% increase in beef exports versus about a very moderate increase in imports. So I think this early data says, wow, it looks like it could be much better than that, than these yearly numbers. But we'll have to see how that evolves as we go forward. And, of course, we have some concerns with the European debt situation in some of those smaller countries at this point. And so that's got the world a little bit nervous about the continuation of the economic recovery. But just like any time, you don't go straight up in terms of recovery. And although it did feel like we went straight down, I guess, in terms of the financial crisis in the fall of 2008.
You did make note in that same document on the export and the imports for beef and for pork, that it showed a supply in the U.S. that was, 5% smaller for per capita or per person
in
the first quarter?
Yeah, and essentially we've got multiple factors going on this supply side. One factor is, as we said, our producers have generally dropped the sizes of the cattle herd as well as the hog herd. That makes less production. Secondly, we're going to see more of the production that we raise in the U.S. and process in the United States go to the export market. That makes it even less available here in the United States. And we continue to get some population growth. So we always look at the per capita supplies, and those are going to be down around 3% on beef here in the U.S. this year, about 5% drop on pork. Turkey, we think, is going to be down around 5% on per capita supplies. Broilers are the ones that are actually responding. They're going to be up about 4%. But when you put all that together, these meats and poultry are going to be down 1% to 2%. Tighter supplies. We had tighter supplies in 2009, even tighter here in 2010. Now with a consumer that's ready to reach into their wallet or their purse and spend a little bit more of that on meat.
Yeah, they'll be spending a little bit more of that on meat, but they're probably going to pay higher prices as well?
Well, there's no question about that. And the retail prices of beef and pork both figure into, we think, why we had such surprising strength in these markets for producer prices. That would be cattle that the producers are selling or the hogs. And the reason for that is that retailers don't typically want to move prices up or even down real sharply from week to week. They want to look more over a period of time, get the general trend. Now, what this has meant is that we have data for the first quarter of 2010, and surprisingly, even though we saw hog prices and cattle prices starting to move up sharply, we saw retailers selling beef and pork at lower prices in the first quarter this year versus the first quarter, same quarter a year ago. Pork, as an example, was about 7 cents a pound lower at the retail level, and beef was about 10 cents lower at the retail level. Now, what that means is there's actually less supply in the marketplace, but retailers are selling it at a cheaper price. So what it seems is that demand is really good. It's pork and beef are flying off the shelf. There's less supply, and they're selling it at a lower price. Now, the bottom line is, what has happened is there's really been a sharp reduction in the retailer margin. The amount of money that the difference between the wholesale prices of these meats and where the retailer is selling it. That's not going to continue. We're going to see retailers sharply move prices of pork and beef up this spring, and we think into the summer. We expect to see record high prices on beef and pork at the grocery store by the time we get into this summer and certainly into the fall. Now, that's where you really test demand, and the willingness of consumers to buy your product is when you push that price up. So this is what causes us to say that probably these $100 cattle per hundredweight, that's just not going to last. We really see those retailers pushing the prices up to the consumer. Consumers are going to pull back some at those higher prices. And what that means is we'll probably drop somewhat on these live cattle prices into the summer. Now, they're going to be strong by historical perspectives the last 2 years, but not as strong as what we saw them this spring.
Strong enough for the cattle producer to continue to make a profit?
Oh, we're going to see cattle prices, we think this year, probably average in the low 90s in terms of prices. We were low 80s a year ago. So that $10 is an enormous amount of additional revenue. And then we have to also look at the feed side. The feed side, we're not looking at $4 corn at this particular point. We're going to be more in the mid $3 range on corn. It looks like for averages finishing out our 2009 crop and then at least initially looking at the 2010 crop. So what that says is lower feed prices and substantially higher revenues from the live prices really does mean there's going to be profitability and probably good profitability, very good profitability for cattle feeders. We're going to see these calf prices bid up 15 to 20 cents a hundredweight or $15 to $20 a hundred this fall versus last fall crop. We're going to see cow-calf producers be at least break-even to making some money. So it is the reversal of the last 2 years with a lot of depression from the recession, from too much meat in the market, and obviously some very high feed prices over the last 2 years.
Hog futures have spiked into the $90 range. Actually, cattle and hog futures aren't all that far apart, only, what, $6 or $7 at this point.
Yes. Yeah, very unusual. And again, we probably have a bit more ability to maintain some pretty strong hog prices. Going into the summer, we really do look for very limited supply of pork, probably down 7 to 8%. And again, on the pork side, as I said, on the retail sector, we're going to see those pork prices moved up sharply by retailers. They were lower early this year, lower, not higher, and that's just not going to continue. We're going to see record high pork prices. But I think, again, we're going to see hog values be extremely strong. We're looking for live weight prices, very high 50s to low $60 ranges for hogs this summer. And then as we get into the fall quarter, we'll be in the live weight prices in the lower 50s. But, you know, for the year, we're going to see very, very strong average prices, I think around $55. And that compares with the low 40s last year. So just really a night and day remarkable turnaround for these industries that have been under such financial stress over the last 2 years.
Which part of the industry on the margin eliminated their herd in the last year? Was it the small producer? And I don't know how many are left in either of them. Mostly in the hogs, there wouldn't be very many. Or did finally the larger producers cut back on the size of their herds?
Well, you know, we've always kind of relied on the smaller producers. We used to call in the hog business the in-and-outers. People get in and out of the business. But that segment is just so tiny anymore, we could not make the adjustments that the industry-wide numbers had to come down in terms of supply to get us back to profitable prices with mid $3 corn. So this really has been the larger producers. Some of the very largest and the largest producer had cut back 13% on their sows. We also saw some of the large producers and one that went bankrupt and just decided to shut down their facilities in North Carolina back in the fall. That was 30,000 sows. So I think the adjustment really was made, and maybe the first time ever in the hog industry, the adjustment really was made by what the hog industry is primarily composed of now, and that is larger hog production companies. That's really what had to happen, and I think the adjustment was so hard, again this time, because it really had to come adjustment, reducing production, to some people that were very well-entrenched, very efficient, and low-cost producers, but they just had to finally admit that they could not make it. We saw our Canadian herds, particularly on hogs and cattle, come down even more than in the U.S. We're major traders in meat with Canada because of our proximity and our very close relations and our trust of each other's health and sanitation standards. So the Canadian producers really got hurt even worse than our U.S. producers over this last 2 years.
That's Purdue University ag economist Chris Hurt talking about the livestock sector here on The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. We'll take a break now, and when we come back, we'll talk with entomologist Mike Gray about the recent release by USDA, or at least approval, of Pioneer's Optimum Acre Max.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
It's National Nutty Fudge Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1777, according to the International Dairy Foods Association, the first ice cream advertisement appeared in the New York Gazette. In 1934, dust shut out the sun over the East Coast for 5 hours, and dust is reported settling on ships 300 miles out to sea in what was the first nationwide environmental disaster. The Dust Bowl days of the 1930s were caused by the clearing of virgin prairie with plows, long drought, and high winds, and it resulted in the formation of the USDA Soil Conservation Service. In 1991, a new cancer drug was announced, which was found in the bark of a rare tree in the Pacific Northwest. And in 1994, Roy J. Pluckett died. He was the inventor of Teflon in 1938. Its invention was an accident. During World War II, the new polymer was applied as a corrosion-resisting coating to protect metal equipment used in the production of radioactive material. The first non-stick cookware using Teflon was sold in 1960. And that's This Day in Agricultural History.
You're listening to The Farming World. It's a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. We'll switch gears from livestock to crops now. Optimum Acre Max was approved by USDA, at least in the short term, through September the 30th of this year, a couple of weeks ago. Mike Gray, entomologist here on campus, has some thoughts on Optimum Acre Max. First, Mike, why don't you tell us just exactly what it is and how it differs from what's already out there?
Well, the refuge in a bag is a concept that has been discussed for quite some time now. It's an approach to manage corn rootworms in such a way that resistance to BT hybrids can either be delayed or prevented. And, of course, the current strategy has been to utilize a structured refuge, growers putting out either strips of non-BT seed or separate blocks of non-BT seed. And so this recent approval by EPA really is a significant departure from where we've been with the structured refuges for BT hybrids. And again, we think back the first BT hybrids, you know, being commercialized in the mid-90s. So we've been using structured refuges for some time at the 20% level for corn rootworms and for corn borers. We know that this year we do have another new development, and we've talked about that before, the use of SmartStax hybrids by producers does allow them the added convenience for the first time this growing season to use a 5% refuge, but keep in mind that's still a structured refuge. So this very recent EPA approval for Optimum Acre Max Pioneer hybrids and utilizing that seed blend mixture, the refuge in a bag, as you mentioned earlier, is very new.
I think it's a foregone conclusion that farmers will like the idea because they don't have to handle a separate issue for the refuge. They just throw it in the planter, and they've got both the ISO line and the stacked line there together. They'll think that's a fine thing, no doubt, because it's less work for them in terms of keeping track of what's where. The question, though, is what kind of questions arise when you switch, do you think, from a structured, this is the place where these insects can survive and mate and live, to a place, to a non-structured, where they may or may not be feeding on the roots and other parts of the plant that may or may not, you know, have an impact on them?
Well, you're right, Todd. I mean, there's no question about it. We've heard from growers. I know industry has heard from growers the idea of being able to simply pour seed out of a bag into planters. The convenience angle is a real, real plus. However, I think the ratio of BT to non-BT seed or refuge seed is going to be of significant interest to producers as well. I know that at our 2010 University of Illinois Extension Corn and Soybean Classic meetings this past January, we asked growers the question, are you interested in using seed blends? And a pretty high percentage of growers indicated across all of our meetings that they very much would like the convenience of being able to do that, as long as the seed blend mixture contained about a 5% non-BT seed. Once we moved beyond that, we found the reception to be a bit cooler towards this approach. And as we know, the registration for these Optimum AcreMax hybrids really sets the seed mixture ratio to that of 90-10. In other words, 90% BT seed, 10% non-BT. So at that level, based upon our surveys of growers at our Corn and Soybean Classic meetings in January, the reception was not quite as warm, because I think there is concern among growers of not being able to come in and rescue those 10% of plants that may have significant rootworm injury. So I think that will remain a concern. But nonetheless, this is a new development, and it does raise a lot of questions.
Why wouldn't they be able to rescue it?
Well, the refuge, in terms of structured refuges, keep in mind, the insecticide applied to those structured refuges takes place at planting as well, whereby growers would utilize soil.
It's been too long. I'd forgotten these were soil-applied sorts of things. I was thinking of coming in and spraying over the top an airplane, but of course there wouldn't be really a way to come back and do this. It's either a soil applied and the refuge area, or take your chances and the 10% hit.
That's correct. I mean, producers have treated refuges, again, at planting with some of the conventional soil insecticides, either granulars or liquids, and that occurs at planting, treatments applied in a band or in furrow. So really no effective rescue treatment should they become necessary.
Other questions that you have that come
along
with this?
Well, I think other questions that will be answered over time, again, with the SmartStax hybrids out there with 5% structured refuges, it begs the question, will we see at some point seed mixture or refuge in a bag approaches with SmartStax hybrids in the future? And if so, what will that seed mixture approach look like? I think this is a question that will continue to be of interest this year for growers, not just in Illinois, but throughout the Corn Belt.
That was University of Illinois entomologist Mike Gray joining us today on The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. You have a very good afternoon. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason.